essential pro-growth tax policies have expired or are being phased out, making it more difficult for U.S. businesses to invest at home, create American jobs, and compete globally. The House has passed legislation to stop these tax increases on U.S. job creators. Now it's up to the Senate to act. It's time to strengthen America's global competitiveness. Pass the Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act.
There's a scene from an old West Wing episode, Slow News Day, in which Toby's assistant, Marina, sheepishly admits that she doesn't really understand the basics of a policy that everyone in Washington is talking about.
Hey, can I ask you a question?
What?
Well, there's something I don't understand about Social Security.
Then you could be a member of Congress.
Well, all these reports say it's going broke if we don't fix it. But if we all pay into it, why don't we just get our money back when we retire?
In Washington right now, the issue that insiders talk about every day, but are often too afraid to admit they don't really understand, is reconciliation.
So every vote counts. Every member knows they're that last vote.
Yeah.
So everyone has a lot of leverage. It's a question of whether they use it and how.
I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. You often see reconciliation described in articles using journalistic shorthand, like an arcane budget process, or the complicated set of rules governing the legislative vehicle Democrats are using to pass their most ambitious climate, tax, and healthcare legislation. The language around reconciliation is studded with jargon about birdbaths and merely incidental provisions. The top experts on the process are a select group of Washington budget nerds who all know each other and become highly sought after when a reconciliation bill is going through the system.
Oftentimes, what starts out to seem as an insuperable barrier can ultimately be conquered.
With a set of six rules written by a long-dead senator from West Virginia, Robert Byrd, this D.C. budget priesthood guides legislators about what's allowed in a reconciliation bill. When there's a dispute, the ultimate authority on those rules is the Senate parliamentarian, who hears arguments behind closed doors in a quasi-judicial setting from which the press is barred. It's a strange process, even for Washington. If you know one thing about reconciliation, it's probably this. In the Senate, a reconciliation bill can't be filibustered. It can pass with a simple majority. And that's why the process has increasingly become the go-to legislative strategy for the most ambitious pieces of a president's agenda. Bill Clinton passed welfare reform using reconciliation. George W. Bush passed his big tax cuts with it. Barack Obama used it to get the Affordable Care Act over the finish line. Donald Trump used reconciliation to open up Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. The price of using reconciliation to avoid the filibuster is abiding by its sometimes inscrutable rules. Bush's tax cuts expired after 10 years because of those rules. Bill Clinton thought he could pass his health care plan using reconciliation until his staff learned about the Byrd rule. Democrats last year tried to raise the federal minimum wage using reconciliation until the parliamentarian ruled that they couldn't. The scope of Biden's legislative success is being decided right now, behind closed doors, in a delicate dance between what's required to secure the support of 50 senators and what the Senate parliamentarian will allow in the bill. So today, we are going to go deep on the reconciliation process with two longtime Republican Senate budget staffers. Eric Euland.
In my previous roles, amongst other things, I worked up on Capitol Hill on the Senate side for a little over 25 years, including time as a staff director for the Senate Budget Committee.
And Greg DeAngelo.
I spent 2 years at the White House Office of Management and Budget, where I ran the healthcare division. And before that, I spent nearly a decade working in the Senate on the Budget Committee.
They've spent years on the Hill, both designing reconciliation strategies to pass GOP priorities and attacking the weak points of the Democrats' reconciliation bills.
How old are you guys, first of all? Just to get the generational differences, if there is one here.
39.
39.
139.
We chatted over iced teas.
The unsweetened iced tea, please.
Coke Zero. Yeah. Thank you, sir.
At Café du Parc, next to the Willard Hotel, near the White House. And we're also going to try to answer a question that hangs over this entire process. If you were starting from scratch, would anyone design a process like this to pass important legislation? So let's talk about the current reconciliation bill. I assume you guys have some visibility into the birdbaths that are going on right now. If what advice would you give?
Not stipulating that, right?
Well, I assume I assume your day jobs have something to do with this. What's your advice to your Republican colleagues who are scrubbing this bill right now? What are the most vulnerable parts of the bill? And what are the parts where you think you just don't have a shot for knocking provisions out? Who wants to start?
I'm happy to give it kickoff. So it's been pretty clear repeatedly over many years that attempting to use reconciliation to ultimately affect significant changes in private activity or behavior is out of bounds. And as you know, even in this much reduced from $10 trillion to teeny tiny reconciliation package here over the last 18 months, there are still ideas in here that attempt to have a significant policy impact on the private sector. Prescription drugs, for example, or the idea about including an insulin price cap inside reconciliation, which we still have not officially seen, but nevertheless is what Democrats are busy advocating. That, based on past guidance from the parliamentarian, would seem ripe as a way to begin the debate about the appropriateness of those pieces and those provisions inside this package being eligible to be able to qualify for the reconciliation process.
Yeah, that's where you start. Okay.
So I think the biggest target I would focus on in the healthcare, the prescription drug space, is the drug negotiation price setting program. And in particular, you know, whether or not that is appropriate for reconciliation, it's a major policy change. And specifically, there is a 95% excise tax that's imposed on manufacturers who don't play ball, come to the table and provide those price concessions in Medicare. But essentially that tax applies across all markets, including the commercial market. It's a tax penalty that raises no federal revenue, i.e. it has no budget effect. And it appears designed solely for the purpose and intent of altering behavior, forcing drug makers to the table. So I'd argue it's not budgetary. And if it is, it's merely incidental to the policy motive of forcing manufacturers to the table, because it, again, extends beyond just the Medicare market to all markets. And that's obviously one of the open items. And, you know, you'll notice there are a couple of open items that have been reported on, and they're all about, you know, roughly $100 billion in potential savings. And if you look at the Congressional Budget Office's most recent score, you know, the bill in total only reduces the deficit by roughly $102 billion. In fact, when you look at the on-budget non-Social Security effects, $88 billion. So any one of these big targets could eliminate any potential deficit reduction. Another example is the blocking of the Trump administration's so-called rebate rule that prevented, basically the offering of rebates within Medicare Part D. That provides $122 billion in deficit
reduction.
That's
in the package now.
That's in the package. Yeah. But in language that has evolved, now they're proposing, the Democrats are proposing to sunset it, because questions are raised about whether it's appropriate to come in and, in a single sentence, repeal a 300-page regulation, whole cloth. Especially when you're dealing with anti-kickback statute, you know, that's a huge policy element to it, despite the huge budgetary effect. And so is it appropriate to do it on a permanent basis? Is it appropriate at all? And whether or not, if you do want to block the rule, do you need to go in and do it on a more surgical basis, right? Or can you, you know, write it in one fell swoop, just block or delay this regulation? Just like Republicans couldn't repeal Obamacare in a single sentence, you know.
Yeah.
Can you stop a regulation in a single sentence, that 300-plus pages? I'm not sure that's appropriate, but I would be focusing on these big-ticket targets because it knocks out all the savings in the bill.
And what's the importance of doing that, that second part?
I think it complicates the deal that the majority appears to have struck, assuming they have 50 votes.
Manchin wants deficit reduction.
It's politics, but it's also ultimately the process. If enough of these are knocked or modified, that suddenly you're skirting the edge of not reducing the deficit in the Finance Committee space by at least $1 billion over 10 years, you have some significant process and policy challenges facing you.
Behind the scenes, the majority is making changes. So they're not just litigating the package for purposes of bird rule compliance, right, and revising it as needed. They're also trying to figure out what's the right policy mix. How do they get 50 votes? And frankly, if you knock out a substantial share of their savings, it makes it harder for them to both meet their instructions and secure the necessary votes when members are lining up with concessions they want that cost money.
And I think that's your poll quote.
That's good. What about on the climate provisions and the, you know, the EV tax credits? Anything ripe for running afoul of bird rule there?
So there, I think there's definitely room to run again for Republicans to make the case that this should not qualify for reconciliation. One thing that I was told long ago by one of Elizabeth's predecessors was, the more dominoes that you bring to me that have to be hit before a policy takes effect, the harder it is for me to understand why that should qualify for reconciliation, especially if the policy you're trying to affect ultimately is more private sector in execution than it is to do with the federal government and puts and takes, outlays or revenues, what you do on the tariff side, things like that. That's always stuck with me over the years, because you can put together a lot of really fascinating Rubik's Cubes of ideas to see whether or not they qualify for reconciliation. But the more things that have to happen for something to actually occur, sometimes that's more and more challenging. Here, for some of the things that have to be done in order to make the EV
the
work.
Way that Manchin has required the EVs.
Right, exactly.
It's like,
yeah,
the chips have to be made in X country. And
And look, I think instinctively, you know, put aside the debate about EVs, yes, items ought to be manufactured in the United States. I do know that in the past, people have gone to the parliamentarian with ideas for tax credits to try to qualify inside reconciliation for domestic content or domestic production. And ultimately, they've run afoul of the process.
Too many dominoes.
Too many dominoes, right?
And that,
and
of course,
private sector impact.
And these dominoes were included to get Manchin on board. So you take some of those away to satisfy the parliamentarian, you potentially lose Manchin.
And it's not a question of satisfying. It's just going to be the guidance. So we'll see how these debates work out. And ultimately, again, to Greg's point, there's a lot that still has to happen behind the scenes to make sure that your policy mix is right, that it qualifies for the process, that you've got your politics squared away, and you're ready to proceed by noon on Saturday in order to try to get this done by early middle of next week.
It's a 50-50 Senate, so every vote counts. Every member knows they're that last vote. So everyone has a lot of leverage. It's a question of whether they use it and how, and whether they all can be accommodated.
If you had to predict, sitting here on Thursday, Schumer says he wants this basically done. I've talked to some of your Democratic colleagues outside of Congress who predict this will pass this weekend, not long after this show is posted. It sounds pretty optimistic to me. But what's if you had to predict, given your experience in these things, what's your prediction on the process going forward?
Yeah, it's unlikely to pass this weekend. If for no other reason that let's argue for the sake of discussion that you're able to adopt that motion to proceed, that you're actually able to get the bill on the floor on Saturday. There's a multi-hundred page substitute amendment that needs to be offered at the beginning of the process. Any senator can insist that be read aloud. And so it will take several hours.
Forget about the bird baths, just that.
It takes several hours to just plow through 700 plus pages of legislative text, even if you're doing the old FedEx fast talking. So the idea that this will pass because Republicans will give up time, or they only have a few amendments, or they'll just throw up their hands.
They want to go back home.
Not going to happen. But if they believe they have their process squared away and that they have their politics squared away with 50 votes, absent some sort of COVID challenge, could they get it done next week? Certainly possible.
Yeah. And on the birdbath, on what's left of the birdbath. What's your prediction? How vulnerable, in other words, do you think it is to some of the challenges that you just discussed? And if you were on the Democratic side and knowing the pieces of the puzzle here, do you think you could navigate the process?
I think the biggest vulnerability, as I mentioned earlier, is the negotiation regime, and in particular this excise tax that doesn't raise any federal revenues. Yeah. And so if I'm them, I'm thinking through contingencies of if
how
that
would
falls,
you fix it if you were them?
How would you fix it? I think they probably have that mapped out. And they were in the early, they had kind of a dry run, an earlier bipartisan birdbath almost 2 weeks ago, and they heard some of the concerns from the minority. And if I'm them, I'm thinking through, well, how do I get ahead of those concerns? How do I modify the language? So in particular, in the revised language, we've already seen a provision that essentially says a manufacturer can opt out of paying the excise tax if they decide not to sell their products in Medicare and Medicaid, which is interesting. I think that that's probably the Democrats pivoting to, if the tax falls, what are the conditions of participation in this program? So that may be the new stick as opposed to the tax, and it may produce a similar budgetary effect. That's just my speculation. It's hard to know where the parliamentarian will come down, but yeah. I saw that as not necessarily just an element of the new tax, but perhaps the fallback option from the majority standpoint, because they're thinking kind of a step ahead. If we lose on this, what do we replace it with, to your point? Yeah.
What's an example of something that you were involved in? And just sort of set the scene. Where do these arguments happen? Who's in there? What's the vibe like? Just take us behind the scenes of this secret reconciliation court.
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, the majority will work on a reconciliation bill for a long period of time, usually weeks or months. They'll work on drafts. They'll get preliminary estimates from the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Taxation behind the scenes before anything's public, and they're privately meeting with the Senate parliamentarian, getting, briefing her on the proposals in the bill, starting to make their case, also trying to get informal guidance from her so that they can get close to being in the ballpark. Do we have a leg to stand on? Are we, potentially going to comply with the Byrd rule? But then at some point, towards the end of the process, when the bill is getting ready to come to the Senate floor, the minority is called in to engage, and they have their opportunity to explain, what is current law, how does this change it, what are the budgetary effects, if any, and what's the case against it. And so that kind of begins this almost court-like proceeding that occurs behind the scenes between the minority staff and the majority staff that ultimately informs the Senate parliamentarian's guidance that she provides.
And that's going on right now with the Democrats' reconciliation bill, title by title. Where does it generally happen?
There are a variety of spaces inside the Capitol building itself on the Senate side where these conversations can occur, depending on timing, size of contingents from the majority and minority. There are two major meeting rooms in the Senate on the second floor where, for large issues, these debates can occur in front of the parliamentarian.
Mansfield room. Yeah.
And the LBJ room.
And the LBJ
room. There's a variety of smaller spaces on the first floor, as well as in the basement of the Capitol, the East Front rooms. Sometimes they can be conducted there. Depending on timing and, again, the size of the contingent, it could be in the parliamentarian's office itself. So all those are possibilities for conducting this. To Greg's point, the majority has worked directly with the parliamentarian. Separately, the minority has worked with the parliamentarian. When it comes time for both sides to be in the room, you generally have staff from the two sides of the budget committee, the two sides of the committee of jurisdiction for the provision at issue, leadership staff from Senator Schumer and Senator McConnell's office in this case, and then the parliamentarians themselves. You may have as well floor staff for the majority and minority there monitoring and facilitating if necessary. Generally, what happens when you're in the room?
It's a lot of people.
It can be. Although with COVID, there's definitely been an effort to lean out the size of contingents when they do this personally so that people are able to have a distance and be able to appropriately observe the proper health and safety protocols. So because leaving the Capitol to do this over in one of the office buildings is just going to be inappropriate. So doing in the Capitol where the parliamentarian has access to his or her material back in the office, if necessary, has the ability to take a step out if there's a need for a pause, as well as facilitate the transition from one group to the next. Better to do it in the Capitol. And then finally, especially when this is done in the evenings and on weekends, the Capitol's closed. So you don't need to worry about somebody just opening a door because they came into work on a Saturday and ta-da, I'm wandering into a bird bath or a parliamentary food fight. And that's important too. So anyway.
Does the parliamentarian preside? I mean, does it look at all like a, like, you know, like the people's court or, you know, is it staged like a court proceeding or is it much more informal?
It's a lot less formal than the People's Court or the Supreme Court, Ryan. So generally what happens is you have a table in the shape of a square. You know, it can be larger or smaller, depending on, again, what it is you're debating and the number of people who need to be in the room. Parliamentarian and staff, parliamentary staff are there. So remember, there's a parliamentarian, there's a deputy parliamentarian. They're, depending on circumstances, one or two other parliamentarians present for the conversation at one part of the square, the head, and then the majority and minority line up facing each other, you know, down each wing, one of the wings of the remaining square, and if necessary, have to turn the corner and bump into each other.
Do you ask each other, can each side ask the other side questions, or is there not a direct engagement?
Initially, there is not a direct engagement. However, there are moments where it can devolve to a direct engagement. The reason Greg and I are chuckling a little bit, the parliamentarians, and I've worked with three parliamentarians, Bob Dove, Alan Fruman, and Elizabeth McDonough, and their teams expect and deserve a respectful presentation and the ability to allow each side to make their points with minimal interruption. However, people are passionate about their policy. This, in some cases, at Greg's point, are things that they've worked on for years, if not decades. Hey, Anwar. And so as a result...
Is it Anwar?
Yeah. So that was a nearly 20-year effort in order to ultimately get that across the finish line. So,
and then it's just like, I remember when it passed, it was like there were 2,000 other things going on in the news that day, and it was like nothing.
The first time we did it, first time we argued it successfully and got it in a reconciliation bill was 1995. So with Bob Dove and the then Energy Committee Chairman, Frank Murkowski, and staff like myself making the case on behalf of it. Okay. But like I say, because people are passionate, there are moments where potentially folks want to interrupt, sometimes do. Sometimes there are some healthy exchanges, shall we say.
Greg, what's the most dramatic debate you've been involved in one of those sessions?
Most dramatic. You know, I think we talked a little bit about the individual mandate provision and whether or not we could eliminate the penalty and whether or not that was different than repealing it. You know, that got very spirited.
So when you went back and said, we've got a new idea, we'll just dial it to zero, the other side flipped out?
I think they knew that, you know, it was, you know, very similar to repealing it, but not repealing it.
Yeah.
But it was hard to make a case why it wasn't fiscal in nature, because it was by definition fiscal. And so I think that was tough, you know, and they, you know, they were very spirited in that discussion. I think other ones, you know, in the past we had provisions that would have prohibited Medicaid funding from going to certain entities, including Planned Parenthood. You know, that got to be very contentious at times, lots of back and forth, very spirited. You know, anything dealing with major policy issues like that, you can imagine, you know, there are strong feelings on both sides.
Why shouldn't reporters be in these birdbaths?
I think the same challenge applies for reportorial or outsider access to a bird process or a budget process as it does for the Supreme Court. The idea that media is there changes behavior objectively. You can't quarrel with that as a member of the media, although I'd be happy to have a conversation about that at some point. I played a reporter and a journalist once long ago. But the need, especially with the clock ticking and a deadline proximate, to move through the process and complete means the idea of the potentiality of playing to the galleries is only going to slow and delay completion of what's an important process designed to push a majority's agenda forward. So in that way, having kind of weighed the pros and cons of access, not just for journalists, but other stakeholders, other offices, and this over the years, the House kind of always come back to the conclusion that the best way for the institution of the Budget Committee and the process is, let's get the practitioners and the advocates in here. Let's get them the ability to speak directly to the person who's going to give the considered guidance ultimately, but let's not turn it into the potentiality of a big old shoe where ultimately all that is a significant impediment for a majority being able to pull off what it's trying to do inside this reconciliation budget resolution process. That's my opinion. Happy to take debate.
Greg, do you want to take the pro First Amendment side or the anti-press side here?
I think, like Eric said, I think it's really important that these deliberations be productive and fact-based. And so, you know, within the current context, you know, the Democrats and Republicans have started to go and do bipartisan bird baths. Most recently, about 2 weeks ago, they did an initial bird bath on some of the prescription drug reforms and haven't received any guidance yet, in part because there were fundamental disagreements over how key provisions would work. And they were tasked with some follow-up information, and they're going to be going back in. But my point is that if you have the media in there and cameras and others and they're playing to audiences, it'll muddy the waters even further.
We talked about this before a little bit, but when the parliamentarian makes a decision, how is it generally communicated, especially after one of the more formal bird baths that we've been describing?
Generally speaking, she'll provide written guidance via email. Sometimes it's a lengthy explanation on some of the more weighty topics. Other times it's, so right now as they're going into these bipartisan bird baths, they're prioritizing these high level, you know, big ticket challenges. But as the bill goes to the Senate floor, I mean, there will continue to be bird rule challenges that are litigated up until the conclusion of the debate and in real time. And so there isn't time for written guidance necessarily in those circumstances. Oftentimes the parliamentarians huddling off the Senate floor with staff from both sides. At that point, they're not trading memos. She's not writing written guidance. She's hearing the arguments in real time.
I'm telling you, yes. Verbally.
Yeah. Yes.
You had an example of this when you were working on the 2017 Trump tax cut bill. No, excuse me, on the Obamacare repeal. Tell that story.
So till the very end of that debate, we were working on two provisions that we were that were modified late. New facts were presented by the minority about the provision that would have prohibited federal funding from going to certain entities, including Planned Parenthood. It raised questions with the parliamentarian, and we were modifying the language and getting new information back from the Congressional Budget Office up until the very end, and we're relitigating a provision that had been in a prior bill in 2015 and had been pre-scrubbed and litigated. So again, even if they provided guidance, if new facts come to light, that can reopen
that can
an issue.
Right.
Another example was there was a state waiver provision where they were contending that some of the pieces and parts of what we were trying to do were more processy and not really budgetary. And so we were litigating those to the very end. And I was telling you earlier how we actually prevailed on both of those fronts in both those cases with some minor modifications to the bill. And shortly thereafter, I came back in and witnessed the final vote and John McCain giving the thumbs down. And so it was a little deflating. We won the arguments and got the guidance we wanted, verbally that is, but ultimately the bill that didn't pass.
This was a pretty important victory from the parliamentary procedure perspective. She gives you the green light and you're on the floor and then the bill gets killed by McCain anyway.
That's right.
how do those verbal decisions sort of get documented and become known as precedent?
There's usually an email that follows.
Oh, there is. So her decisions are
usually put
decisions.
In writing.
Yeah.
And they
yeah.
have notes. They keep yeah. records. So do the staff on both sides.
Yeah, got it. Okay.
But this is why we yeah. talked a little bit about the formal Senate precedents.
Yeah.
You know, when a Byrd rule point of order is raised and there is, you know, a question's put to the chair, there's a vote on the Senate floor. Those are the formal precedents and carry the most weight. However, right. there are a lot of other small p precedents and guidance that's provided, and a lot of that comes from staff recollections,
right.
notes from the parliamentarian,
yeah.
you know, email correspondence she's provided, former staff, and so some of that is you know, harder to track over time.
This whole process is basically a by tradition, it sounds like. Do you think it would help to have it more formalized?
There's been a lot of conversation over the years about formalization processes. So, for example, there was a fascination for a period of time with bringing in administrative law court judges, right?
Oh, interesting.
Or retired
yeah.
cohort that would be on call and run it more like an ad law
yeah.
process with a whole bunch of formalities around all that. The challenge with formality, and I'll put that word in quotes because to each individual, the formality can be different, including whether or not cameras are in the room, is that the Senate is, and House too, Congress writ large, is a unique combination of formal and informal.
Yeah, yeah.
And it would require a lot of members to decide that there are certain things on the informal side we want to put away in exchange for unknowable benefits on the formal side in order to get somewhere new and different. So having had a lot of conversations about this over the years, I'm still always struck that even for some advantages, at least to me, about norms of deadlines and structure of memos and expectations about how to make the argument, especially against a clock, those sorts of things that are part of any legal proceeding and certainly administrative law proceedings, going to members and attempting to convince them that that's the greatest idea. Having done a lot of reform efforts internally in the Senate and with the House during my periods of time up there, that's really difficult to close and sell. And to Greg's earlier point on how all this information is recorded, remember that the only precedents that count are the ones for which votes are held. That's not just a capital
right.
P, that's a capital all letters precedent. That's meaningful.
Yeah.
Everything else that's guidance and the adjustments that people make as a result of guidance are not precedents as we understand them colloquially.
A new parliamentarian could come along and say, no, I disagree with
but
that.
There
the minimum
new,
wage was okay.
New set of circumstances, new facts.
Yeah.
Even for a provision that is exactly the same,
yeah.
circumstances around it may change in the next 2 years. Look, one of the first things yeah. any parliamentarian asks, all three of them, is, okay, show me what changes in current law if your proposal under reconciliation is adopted. So you have to give them the current law and the changes.
Right.
So if the current law has changed in the intervening, perhaps the first
right.
time out it doesn't work, but then Congress has made changes
right.
or it's just in existence and the second time it's fine. That's why Obamacare, which didn't pass by reconciliation, as Greg explained, suddenly was subject to reconciliation when Republicans took charge. Not on the books. You can't use the process to get it on the books in 2009, 2010. But once it's there, okay, things that are mandatory spending, things that have to do with revenues, some of the policies implicit in all that are suddenly able to be explored and potentially changed using reconciliation.
Yeah.
That's a small example of changed circumstances may give you a changed outcome on what you can
yeah.
use reconciliation for.
Okay. Do you think that as both parties use this process more and more to try and push a policy agenda in a Senate that seems very often to be closely divided in the last, you know, couple of decades? Do you think this system is just going to be blown up at a certain point because it's ripe for sort of nuclear option abuse? Or do you think it's not that fragile and as difficult to understand as it may be and as cumbersome as it may be, that it's sort of the way that most major policies get done in the foreseeable future, when neither party, if the filibuster remains intact and neither party has a supermajority?
No, I don't think it would get blown up. I completely agree that while it has significant elements that make it very difficult for most anybody to understand exactly what's going on, even if you had that camera right up in everybody's face, it also reflects some of the most enduring strengths of the Senate and the Congress in particular as an institution. And because its strengths and sometimes its weaknesses are so finely balanced between the majority and minority, the idea of detonating a nuke or a multiplicity of nukes in order to try to get your way, and the consequence of that nuclear winter are always cautionary exhortations to whoever's in charge about that. Plus, because the process requires the best from the best, the most creative thinking from some of the most brilliant people I've ever had the opportunity to work with up on the Hill, oftentimes what starts out to seem as an insuperable barrier can ultimately be conquered through a lot of back and forth, again, sometimes over years, sometimes over decades. And ultimately, members can walk out believing that we pushed the process to the limit. We got everything or most of everything we wanted. And there is more to come after in years to come. That's not a problem. I actually have pretty significant victories I can go home and talk about on behalf of what I did for my constituents.
Greg?
I think the budget process is somewhat broken. It needs to be fixed and reformed. And, you know, there are changes that could be made there and to the reconciliation process. But I don't think, you know, blowing up the filibuster is a likely outcome. And, you know, yeah, ultimately we need to get back toward passing budgets every year, using reconciliation for what it's intended and not abusing the process for policy ends.
Well, that ship has sailed.
It's a different, you know, it's a lofty goal. But, you know, I don't think, you know, I think you need to protect, like...
Do you think I guess one simpler way to ask this question is, do you think we're just relying too much on this unelected parliamentarian, that this system, so much of the weight of this system rests on his or her shoulders because both parties have found this privileged reconciliation vehicle so tempting to achieve its, you know, big policy goals? So each president has sort of upped the ante in what they've tried to do with reconciliation. And then consequently, these major decisions are on the parliamentarian. Think 10, 20 years out with no changes. Is that sustainable?
Well, I'll gently push back at your framing of this question. The responsibility for this process and its outcome doesn't rest on the shoulders of one individual. It rests on the shoulders of members and staff on both sides of the aisle, their engagement with the process and their policy priorities, and their ingenuity of pushing their priorities forward to completion, as well as being fully ventilated and litigated through the process. The guidance from the parliamentarian is incredibly instructive and quite influential, as we talked about here during the course of today. And that guidance is going to continue to be provided, not just in reconciliation in the budget process, but across the entire array of Senate rules, practices, and precedents. And members with creativity, energy, and drive pushing forward their agenda ultimately to success, as they choose to define success, isn't enhanced or restrained by the parliamentarians so much as it is enhanced or restrained by their energy, their creativity, their drive in cooperation with their colleagues and leading staff. Look, members can go make their case directly to the parliamentarian. That's another unique feature we've seen here develop with more regularity in the past several reconciliation bills. It happened off and on. Phil Graham would go down. Pete Domenici would show up with a parliamentarian, Senator Sasser, Democrat from Tennessee. But the idea that members find their ability to prosecute their agenda challenged because they don't have access to the process is belied by the fact that at any time, with the assistance of really smart staff and capable individuals, they can go in and make their case and succeed, more or less. Look at Senator Cruz in 2017. Most of what he wanted to do on education policy was ultimately found appropriate to be used for reconciliation. So there are plenty of examples like that that continue to give me confidence that, to Greg's point, there may be adjustments that need to be made, either in the 50th anniversary, 75th anniversary, 750th anniversary of the Budget Act, but that members will find value of being able to access and utilize this process to push their agenda forward and ultimately to the president's desk.
Anything to add to that?
I think Eric said it well.
Thank you guys very much for doing this. I learned a lot, and I hope our listeners do too. Demystified a very mysterious process.
We understand, and thank you for the questions, because it helps people who have done this, some cases a lot of repetitive scar tissue, kind of understand that for all the knowledge base we might have, there are still lots of people who deserve answers to questions like this. Transparency, information flow, making sure that people understand is part of what's the duty of all office holders and their staff as they choose to interpret it. And part of that is this reconciliation process.
At the 50th anniversary conference in D.C., where everyone gets together to discuss this law, we're going to have at least one panel on transparency in the press. Thank you, guys.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Looking forward to it. Thanks.
And that's our show. Our producers are Afra Abdullah and Kara Tabor. Adam Allington is our senior producer. Brooke Hayes is the senior editor of audio at Politico. Jenny Ament is the executive producer of audio at Politico. Mike Zappler is Playbook's daily newsletter editor. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. I'm Ryan Lizza. Thanks for listening.